Welcome, everyone. I'm joined by Philip Goff, professor of philosophy at Durham University, UK, and the author of many wonderful books like Why, The Purpose of the Universe, Galileo's Error, and Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, the latter of which is aimed at an academic audience instead of the general public, which I only mention because that's the one we're talking about today. Philip was kind enough to join me to discuss arguments against materialism, phenomenal transparency and opacity, the link between conceivability and possibility, and to answer your questions. Philip, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Emerson. Great to speak to you. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
So this is the book we're talking about today, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality.
I don't talk about this one much. It's the boring one. Thanks for reading the boring one.
You know, it's funny you say that because it is boring if you don't know anything about philosophy of mind, I will admit that. But if you do know about philosophy of mind, it's very exciting. And I can attest to that because when I was first getting into it, I don't know, like 2019 or 2020, I want to say, I did come across this book and I was like, I just couldn't follow any of it. I was like, what is he talking about? He needs to talk about the real issues, you know, how you can't put physical stuff together and consciousness springs out. That's the, you know, because I was reading like Galen-Strawson at the time. And then I came back to it a few years later and it was like very, I want to say like nourishing in a way. Like I was looking for something deeper. And it was actually addressing like questions that had come up. And part of why I read it actually was because Hedda Hasselmerk recommended it. I was bringing up some stuff to her in conversation and she was like, oh, you should read Philip's work on this, like about how a posteriori physicalists get our phenomenal concepts wrong. Like you should read that paper. And then that led me back to this book. And it was just like, like I'm not trying to blow smoke or anything. Like it was genuinely like, you know, nourishing to get a book like this instead of kind of the more superficial stuff. So if you learn a little bit of philosophy of mind, this book is actually really, really good. But if you, yeah, it is technical and it's kind of so far down the road that if you're just getting into philosophy of mind, it's not going to make any sense. And there's kind of no point to starting there. You should start with Galileo's Error.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Emerson. Well, you know, flattery will get you everywhere. It's one that, yeah, I suppose it was, I wrote the academic one first. I mean, partly like, I think, you know, philosophers don't write enough for a general audience, but part of it is, I think we're trained to have really watertight arguments and to consider all possible objections. And, you know, people think you're stupid if you haven't considered, you know, all the objections and stuff. So it's kind of, you know, when you write a popular book or a popular article, you've got to loosen it up a bit. You can't cover everything. You've got to lighten the argument a bit. And so it was reassuring with my first step into the public realm to have the academic thing there. So I can say, if you want the full argument, you know, it's there. But
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So we are getting into the philosophy of mind weeds today. So if you're listening to this, you should listen to the zombie episode, the first zombie episode that I made, if you haven't already. But for those who are going to completely ignore that sound advice, could you summarize just like the basic zombie argument against physicalism and we can go from there?
Yeah. So zombies are, well, philosophical zombies, which we contrast with Hollywood style zombies. Philosophical zombies are defined as atom for atom, perfect physical duplicates of human beings, but they have no consciousness, right? So behave just like us, all their inner parts do all the same things as our inner parts do, but they have no experiences. So when they're crossing the road, they'll carefully look both ways, but they don't have any visual or auditory experience of the world. You stick a knife in them, they scream and run away, but they don't actually feel pain. They're just complicated mechanisms set up to behave like a normal human being. Yeah, I find there's a lot of misunderstanding. People think it's something that behaves like a human being, but isn't like physically the same. What's his name? Mathematical universe physicist.
Max Tegmark.
Max Tegmark. I was talking to him and he was thinking zombies are like that. And I said, no, it's atom for atom duplicate. He's like, well, no one thinks that's real. And he was right, of course, that, you know, nobody thinks these things are real. Or I think there's one person who thinks everyone's a zombie except them. But, you know, people don't. The point is not that these are real. It's an annoying philosophical thought experiment that they seem to be conceivable. I don't really like this word because it sort of suggests something more tied to imagination. But really, you can think of conceivability as just logical coherence. There doesn't seem to be any contradiction or incoherence in the idea of something that is physically just like us but doesn't have any experience. And then the crucial step is trying to say, well, if it's conceivable, if it's logically coherent plus some other things, then it's genuinely possible there could be such a thing. Doesn't mean they're real, but if there is a God could have created a world with zombies if God wanted to. You know, that's just a metaphor. You don't have to believe in God. It's just a way of making vivid the idea that zombies are at least possible. And then the final step is, well, if zombies are possible, physicalism can't be true. And that's actually the least controversial. I find people think that's controversial, but that's the least controversial step. Almost everyone, not quite everyone, but almost everyone accepts that, because physicalism is supposed to be that the physical facts, the facts of fundamental physics, fix absolutely everything. They necessitate everything, including the facts of consciousness. So you just couldn't have something that's, if physicalism is true, you couldn't have something that's physically just like me in every way but doesn't have my consciousness, because the very definition of physicalism is that the physical facts fix everything else. Okay, so there's three moves in this argument if you listen closely there. Zombies are conceivable or logically possible. That's the first step. Then the second step is, well, if they're conceivable, then they're genuinely possible. There could be such things. And then the third step is, if they're genuinely possible, then physicalism can't be true. So the last step is the least controversial. The middle step is the most controversial. The first step is widely accepted, but still somewhat controversial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, going in kind of reverse order there, it is pretty clear to me that, you know, if physicalism is true, that would mean that, okay, the consciousness is nothing over and above these brain processes. So if you have those brain processes, then you have to have consciousness. You know, like if the brain is there, all the constituent parts are there, and physicalists are telling us that's all that consciousness is. Okay, well, if those are there, then there has to be consciousness. So if there's even one possible world where you have those constituents there, but no consciousness, then physicalism is false because it makes this dramatic necessity claim. You can think about like the statue David. Like if you have the piece of marble there and it's shaped in the way that, you know, David is shaped, then you have the statue David. You know, there's no way you could have marble shaped in that way and not have that statue. So I mean that's kind of what physicalism says.
Yeah, you should teach philosophy, Emerson. That was really nice to explain. I mean, just I suppose one slight qualification with that, just in case this is rising in people's minds. I guess some part of what it is to be a statue is that you're in a community that thinks of you as a statue. And, you know, if something, an atom for atom duplicate of a statue, appeared by chance arrangement of particles, maybe someone would say that's not really a statue because it wasn't made for that purpose. Still, for a physicalist, those broader facts about society are also determined by the physical facts. So, you know, most physicalists think consciousness is just in your brain. Some kinds of unusual physicalism think, no, actually, it's consciousness is partly fixed by the environment. Andy, what's his name?
Andy Clark?
Yeah.
Okay.
Andy.
I'm not going to lie. That scared the shit out of me because I was thinking of my brother Andy, who has a similar, he has a very similar objection that you're spelling out right now. And I was just thinking about that. And you started going, Andy. I was like, what the fuck? Like, how do you know I'm thinking that?
Well, as it happens, I do have a telepathic connection with your brother Andy. I was trying to avoid mentioning it. But Andy Clark is tempted to not only the extended mind, but extended consciousness. Maybe consciousness is connected up with the people you interact with or the environment you interact with, and activism is closely connected to this kind of view. Okay, but still, the zombie. So we don't just talk about a zombie. We talk about a zombie world where it's the whole world is an atom for atom duplicate, but there's no consciousness. So that would cover those cases too.
Right. And going back to the first step of like the conceivability of zombies, I do find that this idea is really confusing for people at first. It was confusing for me at first as well. People get hung up on like zombies not being nomologically possible, like with these laws and with this matter, like there's no way this could happen. Or they're like kind of intuitive dualists. So they think if you were to just remove consciousness from the physical body, you would just kind of slump over. And they're like, so I don't understand how you could have all the same behavior without, because, you know, mental causation is real, you know, they're not intuitive epiphenomenalists or something. So they think that if you removed consciousness, that would make a difference. And it just makes it harder for them to get the idea of a zombie. Sometimes they'll bring up like robots or like the sensors on automatic doors, you know, just to try to make it intuitive how you can have behavior, like things that react to stimuli. But it's, you know, you don't think it's like anything for the automatic doors to open at the grocery store. Or you could imagine building like a complicated robot that, you know, does some things that are even kind of impressive, but you wouldn't think it's like something that you wouldn't think they have like a point of view. And it's just, you know, the zombie world is just kind of like that. So, if you have to, I guess you could introduce epiphenomenalism and just say, okay, just for the sake of argument, assume this is true. And then it should be a little easier because epiphenomenalists think that if you remove consciousness, you wouldn't even know, like everything would just go on exactly as before. But anyway, yeah, zombies are conceivable. You could just have the physical behavior. You could have a zombie world where you have the same kinds of functional properties, I guess, or, you know, behavior that's carried out without it being like anything for us or for human beings and animals. But is there anything else you want to say about the conceivability of zombies? I guess because some people do push back on it. Like I said, some of it's just confusion. They think that you might be saying they're like nomologically possible. And, you know, that's not what the argument requires. It doesn't require that people around you, it's like actually possible given these psychophysical laws and these laws of nature that the people around you could be zombies. That's not required for the argument. It's the only thing that's required for the argument is that there's nothing contradictory about the idea of this physical stuff without any consciousness.
Yeah, I was having something like this conversation with my sister-in-law over Christmas when I bore people with philosophy at the Christmas dinner table. But I mean, yeah, part of it is this difficulty of passing between these different kinds of possibility, as you say. Anil Seth, in his book, I think, was conflating these different kinds of possibility when he was discussing zombies. But yeah, I suppose a way into it is thinking about AI, you know, or robotics. It seems you can have complicated information, complicated behavior without any kinds of consciousness. So you could start there and say, you know, could there be something, maybe something made of silicon? Maybe you need wet biological stuff to get consciousness, but maybe you could have something made of silicon that behaves just like us but doesn't have consciousness. And then once you're there, well, what would, if that's logically coherent, even possible, you know, what would rule out the logical coherence when it's just suddenly made of biological stuff? Why would the biology, okay, I think people are thinking, well, I think biology gives you consciousness. Fine, we're talking about logical coherence, but why would it be a matter of logical coherence that, you know, biology ensures consciousness? And yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, people always think I appeal to consensus too much, but for what it's worth, in the academic philosophical discussions, there is a broad consensus. 60% on the 2020 Phil Studies survey, 60% of English-speaking philosophers throughout the world think zombies are at least conceivable. So that's adding together the anti-physicalists who also think they're possible, but also most physicalists think they're at least conceivable, right? It's not a, and that's just because, you know, the true theory of consciousness for physicalists, for most physicalists, will require empirical investigation, right? You can't prove it just through a priori logical reasoning. And if you can't prove it through a priori logical reasoning, then it seems like zombies are going to be conceivable, right? It's going to require science to rule them out, not just logical reasoning.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's no a priori conceptual entailment from the physical to the phenomenal. So zombies are conceivable. And alternatively, ghosts are conceivable, like things that are just minds and have no bodies. So we've talked a little bit about different kinds of conceivability and possibility. But as I say, just go back to the first zombie episode if you want to hear more about that. Near the end of that episode, I started to talk about phenomenal transparency and opacity and how that kind of bears on the zombie argument. Can you explain what phenomenal transparency is?
So this is a distinction between two kinds of concept that I introduced to these discussions. Some people did before me, actually. Timothy Sprigg, who was a panpsychist from the... Sorry, did I? Oh, sorry.
No, that's why I was just interested that it was him, because he also... No. Some people attribute the what's it like to be definition that we associate with Nagel,
yes,
to him as well. It's just interesting. Yeah. Also got this.
Yeah. So I discovered later when I was a postdoc with David Chalmers in Australian National University, and we had a reading group on panpsychism, and we read this paper by Timothy Sprigg, and he had basically the same distinction there. Was it Sprigg now? Or was it someone else? My mind's going on that. But anyway, I guess in the more recent discussions, I introduced this distinction. So roughly, a transparent concept is one that is essence revealing. That is to say, for someone who has the concept, you can know, just sat in your armchair, the essence of the referent, what it essentially involves for the referent to exist. So take the concept of a triangle, right? I think plausibly... triangle is a transparent concept, because if you have that concept, you know what it is to be a triangle, right? It's to be a three-sided figure, right? To be spherical, what is it to be spherical? It's for all points on the surface to be equidistant from the center. You don't have to do any science to find out, you know, what a triangle is. You know it just from the idea. Whereas in contrast, opaque concepts don't reveal the essence of their reference. So water maybe is an opaque concept. You don't know just from the concept, just through armchair reasoning, what water essentially is, right? You have to do some science and discover that water is essentially H2O. Or lightning, you know, you have to do some science to know that lightning is essentially a kind of electric discharge, right? People used to think it was the anger of the gods. Did they actually think that? I don't know. That's a sort of cliche. Certainly they didn't know what it was. So here's a question, right? So you got these essence revealing concepts like triangle, you got these opaque essence hiding concepts like water. So what is pain more like? If you think about the concept pain, just through reasoning, do you know what it essentially involves to feel pain, what it is to feel pain? I say you do, right? Because, you know, just to put the point very intuitively, I have given some arguments, but just to put the point very intuitively, pain is just a kind of feeling. It's essentially defined as feeling a certain way. And when you're in pain, when you feel that way, you know what it is to feel that way, right? It's like this. You know, you feel it and you know what it is to feel that way. And that's what it is to feel pain, right? So with something like pain, I'm slightly oversimplifying my view. It's a bit more nuanced, but roughly, once you have the concept of pain and you have the concept through feeling pain, then you know what it essentially is to feel pain. It's a feeling and you know it when you feel it.
Yeah, I think Galen Strawson put it this way somewhere, where he's like, there's a rock bottom sense in which the having is the knowing. And I think that would apply here. But yeah, it's like, look, pain just is a feeling. There's no way you could open up a gap here and say like, well, so you know how pain feels, or whatever experience, like, you know how that experience feels, you know how that feeling feels, but you don't really know the essential nature of that feeling. It's like, no, it just is a feeling. That's what it is. So like, if I know how it feels, then I know what it is. That's all, you know, I mean, transparency is basically just getting at that. So it's a, you know, jargony kind of label, and it might not sound clear if you say like, oh, it reveals the nature of the entity it refers to, you know, it's a priori, like in virtue of possessing that concept, you know, what do you say, what it is to be a part of reality or instantiated in reality. It's like, okay, but just apply that to pain for a second. It's like, you know what it is just by possessing the concept. Like in virtue of possessing the concept, you know its essential nature. You know what it really is, because it's just a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you can make it more vivid with the contrast case. So David Papineau, who's a physicalist who I've engaged with a lot, who when I was a graduate student very kindly helped me argue against him and develop my views, and we've written a paper together. And his view, or what at least used to be, that our experiential concepts are opaque. So let's say you're in pain, you're feeling pain, and you think about your pain and how it feels. He thinks you're sort of pointing inside yourself, right? You say that thing, you just evolved this capacity to sort of point at your experiences. What you're pointing at is it's just a brain state, right? That's what it is. But you don't know that just through thinking about it. So all you're doing is just sort of pointing at something without having any clue what it is. And yeah, that, I suppose that does seem to me implausible. It seems like you have a rich understanding of what pain is when you feel it and you attend to your feeling and reflect on it. I mean, that's why you're so bothered when other people feel pain, because you know what pain is and it's not great. So yeah, I mean, just what one slight qualification about Galen. There might be me and Galen are very, very much on the same team here, but there might be a slight disagreement with his expression, the having is the knowing. I suppose the way I would tend to put it is, to emphasize more, at least, the reflection on the experience. So a rabbit feels pain, but what a human being can do when they feel pain is reflectively attend to the pain and form a concept or an idea of it. And then I would think that at least is the knowing. I mean, things get tricky because Galen wants to press that, you know, there's some sense in which just having the experience is to know about it. And I'm sort of sympathetic to that as well, but at least at the level of conceptual propositional thought, which is what we're talking about now, I would think of that as a more reflective thing. Maybe we don't need to worry about that nuance, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you introduce a word like know or knowledge, I think it could potentially complicate things. And I feel like he is trying to say something a little more, like you could rephrase it and not use the word knowledge. And so it would apply to the rabbit and to us. And yeah, I mean, there's some sense.
Just one other thing in this context. I mean, I just briefly gave the intuition there that you have rich knowledge when you attend to your experiences. And a lot of physicalists more recently have conceded that, actually, and this has become known as the new challenge, which is to make sense of why it seems so rich, our understanding of our conscious experiences from the inside. I mean, think about Mary. Mary's often brought in here, black and white Mary, where she's, you know, knows all the science, but she doesn't know, but she's been raised in this black and white room. She doesn't know what it's like to see color. And it seems, you know, she leaves her black and white room for the first time and sees color. And it seems like she gains some new rich understanding of what it is to see red, what it is to see green. Whereas it, you know, if it looks like you've got Papineau's view, she's just learned to point at something inside herself in a different way. And the thing she's pointing at, she already knew everything there was to know about it from inside her room. She's just learning to point at it in a new way. And many physicalists concede that doesn't seem to be enough to account for the sort of richness of the new knowledge Mary would have. And so that's what's become known as the new challenge.
Yeah, you know, that phenomenal curiosity stuff that you've kind of had on the back burner for a while, I think that's really interesting at like kind of helping make that sort of point. Is that sort of related?
Yes, exactly. I was going to mention that as well. So the way I would press this is say, Mary's curiosity might be satisfied. She might be curious, I wonder what it's like to see red. oh, that's what it's like, you know. Yes, I've got a paper on my website, a short paper trying to press that.
And just learning a new way to point at something is not going to satisfy curiosity, is the thought there?
Yeah.
That's
the thought, yeah.
Well, okay, so I would think that the list of transparent concepts is pretty short. Because, I mean, that's not the only way to understand the nature of an entity. Do you agree that there are not very many transparent concepts, or do you think they're abundant?
I'm not sure I do agree with that, actually. I think, so I, you know, I gave a couple of mathematical examples, but I mean, I think it's nice mathematical examples because they're very precise, but I think there are a lot of rough and ready transparent concepts, like being a friend, being a party. I think you know what it is to be a friend without doing any empirical investigation in the world. It's very hard to precisely specify, you know. Philosophers used to try and do this, you know, give precise, necessary and sufficient conditions for concepts, and then you'd get into this game where someone gives a counterexample, you try to tighten it up, someone else gives a counterexample. You know, people did this for decades with the concept of knowledge, and philosophers have tended to say these, oh, just maybe you can't do that, but you still know what it is to be a friend, even if you're incapable of precisely articulating the definition. So I would say actually we have a transparent concept of being a friend, being a party, lots of things like that. But it's just because it's harder to precisely specify the essence. But I would say that's compatible with grasping the essence, although that is a little bit confusing if that is the case.
Okay, so... yeah, okay. So we can, I mean, I talk about this all the time on this show about how we can understand what a concept means, or like what a word means, without being able to give a definition, like without being able to give necessary and sufficient conditions that are free from counterexamples. Like if you couldn't say you understood a term until you did that, you would understand basically nothing. Like there would be no terms that you understood.
That's a good point.
And most people could not do that. And besides, that's not how language arose, you know, like it. If you think about the gradual evolution of language, it's not like there were ever necessary and sufficient conditions involved when we're using words. But anyway,
it's
just a really implausible view, but it's something you can still find people who they'll like defend it. They'll hate. They're like, oh, I hate this Wittgensteinian crap, you know, of like family resemblances or whatever. It's like, I'm sorry, this is true.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan of Wittgenstein, but I think there were certainly insights in, and you know, the it's just not true across the board as Wittgenstein thought. But yeah, and like I think transparent concepts for me are very important because it seems to me like our knowledge of the world, our understanding of the world, insofar as we understand it, has to bottom out in transparent concepts. If all our concepts, which Papineau in one of his papers does say all of our basic concepts are opaque. We just sort of point. Like it seems to me that, I mean, we don't really understand anything. We're just sort of pointing, and surely our knowledge has to bottom out in. So, you know, actually, I mean, my contribution to this, I was really happy doing my PhD when I realized I disagree with David Chalmers on something. So I've got something to say. And, you know, he just sets up this semantic framework called two-dimensional semantics. I mean, he wasn't the first person to have a two-dimensional semantic framework, but he had his version that just takes that for granted, and all concepts bottom out in a sort of transparent element. And then I thought that's a bit generalizing too much, and I never thought he had a very good justification for that. So I suppose my contribution to this was to say, well, let's just say, look, there are some transparent concepts, there are some opaque concepts, and let's just think about the ones we're interested in, phenomenal concepts. Mm-hmm. And there it seems, you know, to my mind, at least pretty plausible that they're transparent. So that's the difference between me and Chalmers, right, for people who are interested in this. Chalmers has this framework where he doesn't, you know, where all concepts have a transparent bit. It's a bit complicated to get a handle on, but... whereas I just focus on experiential concepts in particular and have the argument there.
Yeah. I mean, in general, it does seem like Chalmers has a more like all-encompassing modal rationalism, and your, like, regardless of what your views on modal rationalism are, like, someone could use your arguments because you're kind of focused on phenomenal transparency specifically, so you can kind of bypass some of the stuff about like two-dimensional semantics and stuff and still make the argument.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So it's just, it's just when you're using transparent concepts, you can move from conceivability to possibility. So it's very limited in scope, which I think is an advantage. Another advantage is it's bloody easier to teach. When I first started teaching, I used to teach Chalmers two-dimensional semantics to undergraduates. And I taught Jack Symes, if people know Jack Symes off
Love Jack.
I taught him as an undergraduate, people might not know, when I was a young lecturer and he was a young man. And I remember teaching his class two-dimensional semantics, but everyone was just like, I can't remember what Jack's personal reaction was, but everyone was like, what the hell are you talking about? So now I think my view is, whether it's better than it's better, but it's at least a bit easier to get a grip on.
Yeah. So it's your fault that Jack is this way, is what you're saying. I mean, it's worth pointing that out, though, that if transparency is false, then it's not clear that our conceiving is really worth anything, because our knowledge about consciousness in that case would have to come empirically, right? And then that would just leave the door open for like a type B view. So if consciousness is transparent, that really matters to this like second premise of the zombie argument, because if it's opaque, then, you know, type B physicalism can make sense, because we just don't know very much about the real nature of consciousness. So our conceiving, like, in general, if you don't understand like the nature of an entity, then your conceiving related to it just doesn't matter. Like, if you just don't know,
exactly.
Like, you know, so it, but if these concepts are transparent, then you understand their essential nature. And then now your conceiving is worth something. And now there's this link between conceivability and possibility, because you understand the nature of the entities involved, the properties involved. Yeah.
Exactly. To me, it all hangs on this. And that was the move I made from moving on from what David Chalmers was setting it up, is to say, look, this is what we need to focus on. This is what we need to focus on. I wonder whether, I'll have to ask Dave this, I wonder whether he was just a bit embarrassed to talk about essences. But essences, since when David was first writing, have become a lot more taken seriously in hardcore metaphysics. People like Kit Fine and, you know, interested in taking very seriously this kind of old school notion of essence. Yeah, I think my theory of the history of philosophy, we've sort of gone in this scientistic period and then, you know, slowly coming out of it and thinking, yeah, maybe some of these old school ideas had some force. Anyway, I'm rambling a bit, but you're completely right. So I think David Papineau's view makes perfect sense. You know, you just, when you're feeling pain, you're pointing at something, but you don't know what it is. So it could turn out to be a brain state. Yeah. If your concept of pain doesn't reveal anything at all about what pain is, then sure, it could turn out to be anything. It could turn out to be a banana. But, you know, we just look to the science. That makes perfect sense. But if you know what pain is, independently of the science, then that's going to put some constraints on your science. And then both the zombie thing and the Murray thing is a more sophisticated way of making that point. Yeah. So if you don't know anything about what experiences are, then zombies are conceivable, but that doesn't tell you anything. You can't move to them being genuinely possible. And, you know, Murray, maybe slightly more complicated with the Murray point, she basically learns a new way of pointing at something. So what? Mm-hmm. You know, it still doesn't tell you what the hell she's pointing at. Could be just a brain state, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's to me what it all hangs on.
Yeah,
but just let me say, this is so pleasurable, Emerson. Usually, I'm doing a lot of podcasts where you've got to think, how can I make this understandable? How can I dumb this down? How can I? People are just gonna say, you say it all, and then people say, but how'd you test it? And it's like, you do plumbing philosophy. I've started saying blummin instead of bloody. It's because of my kids. I'm saying bloody all the time in front of the kids. And now it's a bit embarrassing when I'm saying blummin all the time. Anyway, this is so nice just to be able to talk about the details. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, no, thank you. No, I appreciate that. So it's not just that it's like convenient for type B physicalists to accept opacity. It's like you have to accept opacity. Like if you want to be a type B physicalist, you have to reject what we said earlier about like, well, yeah, you know what pain is. Pain is just a feeling. You've felt the feeling. You know what it is. Type B physicalists have to reject transparency. They have to accept opacity, I think, for their view to make sense. Is that right or no?
It's a little bit more complicated, unfortunately. I mean, I would say they have to accept that, and the view only makes sense if they accept that. But there are a couple of other options people try to push to complicate the landscape. So one option is, you know, we've just talked about the extremes, right? Perfectly transparent reveals the total essence, or perfectly opaque reveals nothing. Some people have suggested a middle way option of what I call translucency, that maybe experiential concepts reveal something but not everything. And then we get into the details. Okay, what do they reveal? What don't they reveal? And I mean, I find that sympathetic. Actually, a lot of panpsychists like that idea, but a lot of people just say that and then that's it. And then I want to say, okay, but you've got to give me the details. You've got to tell me, like, what do they reveal and what don't they reveal? And, you know, I've tried to go through all, I was peer reviewing a paper on this week, you know, all extant versions of that, and say they really end up being problematic. Some people have pressed, which is rarer, but some people have tried to go for, is to say, no, it's perfectly transparent, perfectly essence revealing. So the physical concept reveals the essence of the brain state. The experiential concept reveals the essence of pain. But they're just two radically different ways of revealing the same thing that at the conceptual level just do not connect at all. And I sort of jokingly call this Trinitarian physicalism. So, you know, it's like you say, well, the Father is the Son, and but is not the Son, but they're, you know, they're different things, but they're the same thing. And I don't know, it's certainly, you know, that they're just radically, radically different ways of grasping one and the same essence is hard to make sense of. It certainly makes it very different to normal scientific identities, right? Normal scientific identities, you know, you think, what the hell is this thing, water? You do some science, you find out it's H2O, you know. Before you do the science, you're just sort of pointing at it, you don't know what it is. What the hell is that flashy thing in the sky? Do the science, it's electric discharge, right? So that's easy to make sense of. But this idea that you fully grasp the essence, and then, well, there's nothing. It seems like if you fully grasp the essence, there's nothing for the science to teach you. But then one, are you fully grasp the essence in some different way, like the Father and the Holy Spirit? I don't know. Anyway, yeah, so I've tried to say, like, where you just lose all constraint in science if you could do this, you know, if you could just identify things in this totally unconstrained way. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's when you get to the point where you're like, yeah, maybe it's a banana, or maybe it's a pizza, like Galen Strawson says, with pizza theory of consciousness. I mean, why not?
Maybe the spirit of the forest, the loving spirit of the forest, is identical with the bark. So, you know, you'd lose all constraint.
Okay, so just to be clear, according to phenomenal transparency, one knows everything essential that there is to know. Because I often find myself kind of hedging, not out of principle, but out of cowardice, and just saying, oh, you know something essential. You know, clearly I know something essential about my experiences by having them. But you're saying transparency requires that I know everything essential. And what I'm saying sometimes when I say something essential, that would be more translucency.
Yes. Yeah, so transparency means everything essential, but we need to be clear what that means. It doesn't mean all necessary features of it. It just means you know what it is to have that property. So like with a triangle, it's like to have three sides, right? That's what it is to be a triangle. So it doesn't mean you know every, you know, mathematical implication of that, like Pythagoras' theorem and all that. It just means you know what it is to have that property. So likewise, to know the essence of pain is just to know how it feels to be in pain. If you think the way of feeling defines what pain is, then knowing the essence is knowing how it feels, right? And, you know, the reason I go for that is because it's hard to think, well, what? So, you know, most people are happy to accept what it is to be in pain is to feel a certain way. I mean, how could you sort of partially grasp, you know, which bits of that would you get and not get and so on? It gets kind of complicated. Well, actually, I mean, in more recent papers, I've got a recent paper I put up on my website on thinking about these arguments in connection to the existence of God and modal ontological arguments and stuff. And there I give a slightly more nuanced version of this where I say, like, insofar as you know how it feels, to that extent you grasp the essence. So I'm very much open to the idea that we might not be getting all aspects of how our feelings feel. And, you know, change blindness gives you empirical evidence for this. And when you meditate, I think you realize how you're in daily life, you're missing out on lots of the subtleties of your experience. So that's why I give this slightly more nuanced version. You know, to the extent you know what the experience is like, to that extent you grasp the essence. But even if you were to give up on that, it's not game over. Because then the question is, okay, well, what do you grasp and what don't you grasp? And then we'll work with that. So Robert Schroer, for example, a physicalist, has said, you just grasp kind of resemblances between color experiences, for example. Now, I think that would, if that was all we grasped, then physicalism would be safe because those kind of resemblances would come out in the physical science. But I don't think it's plausible that that's all we grasp. I mean, if that was all we grasp, actually, I was peer reviewing a paper recently and they made this point that I hadn't thought of. If that was all we grasp, then physicalism wouldn't seem at all strange or mysterious to us. You know, if the only thing we grasp was resemblances, you know, that it's completely comprehensible. It's completely comprehensible how resemblances between color experiences could be explained in terms of brain science, right? So there wouldn't be any mystery. There wouldn't be any sense of a hard problem. But anyway, that's just one starting point argument. But yeah, so I'm afraid there are very complicated dynamics here. You know, do we grasp the full essence? If only a bit, how much? And then we can examine that and see how that would impact into the arguments.
So, I mean, this kind of, like, this pathway is kind of leading to this argument against physicalism, where it seems like if physicalism is true, and phenomenal transparency is true, like, just, you know, connect those two thoughts, like, we're like, these are essence revealing concepts and consciousness is physical. Well, then, you know, shouldn't we know consciousness is physical? Like, shouldn't we know about some neuroscience just by having experiences? And that's obviously false. You know, you don't know anything about neuroscience just by having experiences. But it seems like physicalism would imply that that should be the case, as long as you're already accepting phenomenal transparency. So that's, you know, why I'm thinking, if you're a type B physicalist, you have to reject phenomenal transparency, because the, you know, conjunction of these two views means you should be able to do some neuroscience just by having experiences.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of pressing the initial case for the argument here. If you completely grasp the essence of pain, then science shouldn't be able to tell you anything about the essence of pain. Or if the essence of pain is physical, you ought to know that just through attending to experiences. So yeah, I find that very compelling. But of course, there are these, what I call, in a friendly mocking way, Trinitarian physicalism, mm-hmm. will say, well, it's just different ways of grasping the same essence. And, you know, we've got to engage with that possibility.
Well, I mean, it is very, very weird, though, to, you know, because, like, if you say Clark Kent is Superman, that might be surprising at first, but, like, I can see how those two things are intelligibly connected. I'm like, oh, it makes sense that those two guys are the same guy. And you can give other examples of identity where I'm not just, like, left completely in the dark, where you're just telling me, like, hey, you know, metaethics is identical to pizza. And I'm like, that doesn't really make any sense to me. Whereas, like, with Clark Kent and Superman, or water and H2O, or, you know, heat and kinetic energy or whatever, like, there's this kind of intelligible connection where I go, yeah, that makes sense. You know, but, like, is this why non-physicalists often invoke the concept of, like, brute necessities? They're saying, like, oh, physicalism requires you to believe in brute necessities, which are unlike other necessities in nature. Is that kind of why they bring it up?
Yeah. So I suppose, yeah, strictly speaking, they do go for brute necessities, and I try to press that that's like weird and unmotivated. And but they try to say, well, it's not that weird when you think about it. What they try to press is it's just something weird about the concepts, right? Maybe that they're just these weird pointy things that don't reveal anything about the nature. But then again, you know, I find that implausible as an account of our experiential concepts. But even if it were true, you'd think we wouldn't find the hard problem hard. We wouldn't find it mysterious. If you're just kind of pointing at something, you don't know what it is, and someone tells you it's a brain state, okay, fine. I didn't know what it was, so it might be a brain state. Whereas we do find that identity at least hard to make sense of. I mean, actually, David Papineau concedes this, and he thinks actually all of the arguments are pretty rubbish. All the arguments against physicalism are pretty rubbish because the type B option is there. And he accepts that we nonetheless have this deep difficulty accepting physicalism. He himself says, you know, he has great difficulty accepting physicalism, even though he's a physicalist. And then he says, well, it's just, this is a psychological question. This is an interesting psychological question. Why do human beings find it so hard to accept that feelings are brain states? So yeah, so that's how he'd go with that, which is kind of an interesting take here. So he'd say, yeah, just looking at the arguments, there is nothing mysterious here. The reason people are taking seriously these arguments, psychoanalyzing me and David Chalmers now, is saying, really, we just find it psychologically so hard to accept physicalism, and so we try and justify it with these arguments. Obviously, he would never press that ad hominem as his main argument, but that's what he suspects is going on.
I also find it hard to accept things that are not true. Like, if you explain to me a view that is manifestly false, I have a hard time psychologically accepting it. That frequently happens with me, I find. But
I've had some fun times with David Papineau. I have a memory of being at a conference in Finland, I think, at 3 a.m, arguing about physicalism and arguing about transparency, phenomenal experiential transparency. And he was holding a bottle of beer, hurling it in my direction, saying, it's religious. It's just religious. It's like revelation, like gesturing at me and bits of his beer spitting out the top of his bottle. And yeah, we've had a lot of fun together.
That does sound like a philosophy conference for sure. 3 a.m, drunk, screaming about philosophy. Okay, so phenomenal transparency, I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, it just, when you spell it out for me, I'm like, yeah, that's true. But you actually do have some arguments for it, or it's like kind of, it has some support. It seems like you go from this thing called super justification to revelation to phenomenal transparency. So can we start with super justification, which, again, it's one of these jargony terms, but it's like, you know, you have beliefs that are justified, but you have some beliefs that are seemingly more justified. You know, like, everyone thinks that like 1 + 1 = 2 enjoys like a higher degree of justification, you know, like Morian facts. Like, there's a short list of things that we are extremely confident in, and then there are other things that we're very confident in that we're justified in believing, but not as much as like 1 + 1 = 2 or I'm conscious or things like that. So just that super justification label. Again, just sometimes when you introduce jargony terms, people get upset, but that's all it means. It just means there's this class of terms that are extremely justified. So why does that concept matter to phenomenal transparency?
Oh, wow. We're really getting into the details. Do you know, I've done hundreds of podcasts and I don't think I've ever talked about this argument. I've never got into the details on a single one. I should have, you know, when I went on Joe Rogan, I should have brought this up. He would have got it straight away, because we had no problems at all getting into the details. So
that was a real meeting of the minds. That
was a little bit of British sarcasm. Deep there. I think, you know, since Descartes, people find it plausible that there is some special epistemic status to our knowledge of our own minds, our own consciousness, as Descartes put it. You know, the mind is better known than the external world. And, you know, one way into that is to see, that skeptical doubts about the external world are much easier to entertain than skeptical doubts about one's own mind, right? It's really easy to think, oh, maybe I'm in the Matrix. Maybe this is all a dream. But then to think that maybe my own consciousness doesn't exist, and maybe the evil computers are making me think I have feelings when I don't, that's much harder to get into. Now, I don't go so far as Descartes to say it's certain. I just say there seems a much higher degree of certainty, rational certainty, in the sense that very high credence is warranted or justified. And it's what I say is it's something like the level of certainty in mathematics, right? So I'm not even saying 2 + 2 = 4 is certain, but our knowledge of our own pain when you're in pain feels something akin to that. It's warranted to be very, very certain, if not 100% certain. So why does that matter for these arguments? Well, we kind of want an explanation of that. And I think the best explanation of that is to accept this transparency stuff, that when we attend to our experiences, the essence of the experience is immediately given to us. And I think that would make sense of how we have this very, very justified knowledge about our experiences. So the example I give is, if you think about you having an experience of red and an experience of orange, like at a particular moment, and you reflect on them, and it's apparent to you that they resemble, that maybe the orange experience is more similar to the red experience than it is to some black experience or something. And that knowledge seems very, very certain. Right, it seems something that you can have this super justification about. What explains that? Well, here's a natural thought. What explains it? You immediately grasp the essence of the orange experience. You grasp the essence of the red experience, and it's thereby apparent to you that they have a similar essence. A little bit like I think with mathematics. I think in a different way. I think our relationship to numbers is different to our relationship to our experiences, but I think we grasp the essence of mathematical concepts, what it is to be a triangle, what it is to be a number, and therefore certain necessary connections are thereby made apparent to us. So I think something like that is going on in the case of our experiences. So it's sort of I had to look back at my boring book in preparation for this, and I give it as a sort of inference to the best explanation. So I think the way I put it is, I mean, I think phenomenal transparency seems true. And if in this case you accept that things are as they seem, therefore phenomenal transparency is true, you get a nice explanation of super justification, right? So assuming things are as they seem explains something which is, I take to be quite evident, that we have this very special justification, very special epistemic status concerning our beliefs about our own conscious experience.
Yeah, and something that would be hard for physicalists to explain, I guess, is the other part of that. Like, so if you accept phenomenal transparency, then there's not really any deep mystery here about super justification with, you know, regard to like experiences that resemble versus experiences that don't. Now, physicalists have like tried to address this. They have some explanation for how you could be this justified, but it is pretty weird. If you think about it as a physicalist for a second, like how do you end up just, you know, through purely physical mechanisms, somehow there's this special class of beliefs that are like certain, like you can be really confident in. So, I mean, do you think physicalists can account for these like super justified beliefs?
No, is the short answer. But I think they would disagree with me on that. I mean, Essa Diaz León, who's a very good physicalist friend and philosophical frenemy, you know, she just said, well, maybe it's just a very reliable mechanism. Something like, okay, you can have a very reliable, when you have very reliable empirical knowledge, skeptical doubts are still very easy to entertain.
Yeah, no, I think my eyes are really reliable, even despite my glasses. But I mean, I can still entertain, like, you know, matrix scenarios and skeptical scenarios. Yeah. But again, there seems to be this special class that goes above our empirical knowledge.
Yeah, I find it hard to think how they could explain it, to be honest. I remember Frank Jackson saying he was happy to bite the bullet and deny it. That's an option. I don't really have any argument for that. You know, you've got to start somewhere. It seems to me a good starting point that this that the knowledge of our own experience is better known than other kinds of knowledge. Yeah, I don't know. I'm baffled. Ask a physicalist.
Yeah, that's what Ralph Stefan Weir said to me. He's like, you know, you're bringing on the wrong people to your show if you want to know what, this kind of stuff. But you also mentioned, so yeah, there's the resemblance stuff, but you also brought up pain earlier. Like, we know that pain is all else equal bad, you know, plausibly because we understand what pain is when we feel it. Anyway, we can come back to this, but I was reading a criticism of the super justification point, and he kind of broke it down into three different introspective judgments. The first one is just, I'm having an experience right now. Yeah, that's super justified. I'm having that kind of experience right now. So, like, you know, a reddish experience. Okay, yeah, that's super justified. And then the third one is the resemblance stuff. Like, that experience now resembles that experience now, like red and orange resemble. And it seemed like he was trying to argue that physicalists can, they have an easier time accounting for the first two, just that they're having an experience and that they're having that kind of experience right now. And it's really the third one, the resemblance stuff, that they have a harder time explaining. But he tried to attack the resemblance stuff and saying, like, well, okay, sure, red and orange resemble each other, but then a C note on a guitar, does that more or less resemble a C on a piano or a G on a guitar? Like, which one resembles more? Does the C on a guitar resemble more? Or you can just pick, you know, any number of experiences. Like, I'm looking at a black slab of pavement, you know, and then I feel nostalgia. Like, is that more or less similar to, you know, the sensation of hearing the sound of my voice or a trombone or something? So he's kind of questioning. I'm probably not doing a great job summarizing his argument, but he's like, he's saying that it's easier for physicalists to account for one and two than it is for three, but three is really implausible. You know, the resemblance stuff is just limited to a short list of cases, basically. And physicalists can't explain that, but that's implausible anyway. So what do you think about that sort of response?
Yeah, I agree the first thing is easier for physicalists to explain. I mean, there is a way of trying to explain this that Papineau gave at one point, although he doesn't like the view anymore, but also Kotelin, because of Hungarian pronunciation, Kotelin Balog, who's probably one of the physicalists who's tried to come closest to anti-physicalists in the concept of experience. And she's trying to capture as much as she can get out of, you know, how, and common sense, I would say, but she agrees with the intuitions of the anti-physicalists in terms of thought about experience and the concept of an experience. So she has this constitution account where she thinks the concept of, let's say, the pain refers to the pain by literally physically encompassing it. And the pain kind of partially constitutes the concept or the idea of it. So the idea of pain is a brain state. You know, the pain is a brain state, and the latter is inside the former, right? So the brain state that is the pain is kind of inside the brain state that is the thought about the pain. And then she thinks this gives all sorts of unusual epistemic implications. Like, you can't be wrong, because the thought kind of essentially involves the thing it's referring to. So you can't have the thought without the referent existing. So yeah, so that's perhaps an option. I would argue even against that. But yeah, certainly the resemblances is much harder to make sense of. Okay, this person you're referring to says it doesn't happen very often. Well, if it happens at all, you still need to explain it, right? So right. So I think ultimately you'd have to bite the bullet and say, I mean, the resemblances is just a particularly vivid example that it's easy to hone in on. I think it's really across the board. This, you gave the other example of the normative implications of pain, the badness of pain might be another example. I think I've thought of others I can't think of right now. But yeah, look, if there's one counterexample to your theory that stands up, then your theory isn't true. So
yeah, I do think it needs to be accounted for. And I mean, maybe if they go for this partially transparent concept, like Robert Schroer I mentioned earlier, maybe they could say, well, the concept of Orange Experience and the concept of Red Experience, it's part of the concept that they resemble. So actually, this might be a way of getting around this point. Then I get, but then the problem then is it's hard to capture the certainty. Okay, so the concepts of Red Experience and Orange Experience guarantee the resemblance, but now how do we know those concepts are satisfied? That is to say, how do we know those concepts are accurately capturing the brain states they're referring to? So actually, you reminded me of how I argue in the book, actually. So I sort of set it up as a dilemma, you know. The more you build into the concept, then you can get the sort of certainty once you know the concept is accurate. But then you have a dilemma. How do you know the concept is accurate? Whereas the less you build into the concept, it's hard to see how you justify the knowledge of the resemblance at all. So look, we've got a very simple explanation here, you know, that phenomenal transparency is true. We grasp the essence of each experience, and it's thereby evident to us that they resemble. Unfortunately, it entails anti-physicalism, but, you know, bends the brakes.
Okay, so like we want to have conceptual dualism, right? Like, we want to have a distinct physical concept and a distinct phenomenal concept, and anyone who accepts there's no a priori conceptual entailment from the physical to phenomenal is going to accept a kind of like conceptual dualism, at least. But if phenomenal concepts are transparent, does that make it harder for there to be like a true conceptual independence, where you have these, you know, a little bit like how you were talking earlier about the implausible physicalist views? Like, does that come back to bite us a little bit if we're saying, no, phenomenal concepts are totally transparent, but we have this other concept, these, like, you know, distinct concepts that, you know, we are like at least conceptual dualists along with type B physicalists and all that, but we say phenomenal concepts are totally transparent. So is it hard to have those two things coexist, basically, transparency and conceptual dualism?
Well, the way we make sense of it, I suppose, is that the physical concepts are not transparent, right? And so that leads into the panpsychist view that the physical concepts don't reveal the nature, the essence of the physical state. So then you insert the phenomenality there. Yeah, I mean, I think if there's conceptual dualism and there's physical transparency and phenomenal transparency, that does seem to lead to dualism. But the way around that is to say it's the physical concept that gives way here.
I see. Okay. So you could still be a monist as long as one of these two is opaque.
Yeah.
And we say the physical is opaque and they say the phenomenal is opaque. I think saying the physical stuff is opaque is a lot more plausible than saying the phenomenal concepts are opaque.
It's certainly a lot easier to make sense of.
Yeah. It's like, I think the stuff out there, it's more plausible to say, yeah, I don't really know the true nature of like the cloud in the sky. Like, it's more plausible to say, oh, I have to go do science. I have to like do some empirical investigation or something. Whereas with like phenomenal concepts, I feel like I just know what those are because I'm conscious. That seems more plausible to me than flipping it around or saying they're both opaque, I guess. I guess maybe both opaque is, in a way, it's like more consistent than saying, oh, physical concepts, transparent. Phenomenal concepts, completely opaque.
I mean, there's a sense in which, it depends how you define a physical concept. If you're just meaning something kind of totally behavioral or functional, I'd say it probably is transparent. And then you do have a kind of dualism. You know, I think you can separate out the phenomenal property and the physical property. I think they're necessarily connected, but in a sense, they're distinct properties. But if by physical concept you're meaning to refer to whatever's underlying the structure or the functional properties, then it sort of falls out that it's kind of opaque or semi-opaque or something.
Yeah, I think you did mention in a footnote that you specify like pure physicalism, which gets at that distinction that you're making. Pure physical concepts are transparent, but then we'd start getting into the Russellian monist stuff. So unfortunately, you're going to have to go here in a second. I wanted to talk to you about your your argument against an essentially conscious necessary being, which you hinted at earlier. That's very interesting. But you are working on a book about religion right now. Would you divulge some of that for the audience?
Oh yeah, just started this week actually. Yeah, what's the idea? I suppose this is going to be a less persuady book, I suppose. I'm just trying to outline a take on religion, a way of engaging with religion, a way of thinking about religion that I think might appeal to the spiritual but not religious. I suppose that's who I'm aiming, my target audience really. And I'm just trying to say to the spiritual but not religious, look, there are things you can get out of being religious. You know, you can get structure, community. Religion has a unique way of kind of bringing the community together. And being spiritual but not religious can be a little bit lonely, unstructured. And then I suppose addressing a lot of issues people have. Isn't religion really kind of backward in its ethical thinking? And I'm sort of saying, well, Jesus is pretty woke, for example, or you know, there are always liberal ways of engaging with religion if that's your thing. Or, you know, a lot of people find kind of Western religion, or at least kind of the Abrahamic faiths, very unspiritual. And one thing I'm exploring in the book is the mystical traditions in all of the Abrahamic faiths, right? You know, Kabbalah, Sufism, there's always been Christian mystics right back from the start. I think, you know, that really, for me, and I'm sure for many others, resonates at a spiritual level. And also, of course, then there's isn't it anti-science? Isn't it just discrediting all that and engaging with the more philosophical stuff? But yeah, I just suppose I'm kind of, and it, you know, it's not going to be like, this is the one true faith, this is what you've got to do. I'm just trying to say, here's a way of thinking about it. You might not have thought about it in exactly this way, and maybe it's something that would appeal. Maybe not, but you know, yeah, might still be of interest.
It's bringing me back to the first conversation we actually had, which is about secular Christianity.
Yes.
I almost forgot that we had that, but it sounds like you've changed in your thinking a lot. I mean, first of all, now you're a theist, so that's one difference. But also, is there any like major difference between where you were as like a secular Christian and where you are now, other than the acceptance of finite theism?
I would say so. Yeah. So I have been engaging with, I've been a churchgoer for many years as a fictionalist, and now I'm a sort of heretic. I would say that's sort of given me a deeper engagement with it in ways I could go into with a bit more time. But what I would like to say in the book is I think religion should be open to both possibilities. And you know, I think it would be good. I mean, it's difficult, right? You don't want to just say, oh, I can understand conservatives saying, oh, we don't want to get rid of all of the faith and all of the mm-hmm. propositions that define the faith. I can kind of understand that. But what we can do is we can say, look, here are the propositions that define the faith, but be open to people engaging with them in their own way, maybe taking them metaphorically, maybe being agnostic about them, maybe having a slightly heretical way of understanding them. You know, some people are going to not like that and not be up for that, but certainly many churches and synagogues and so on are open to that kind of way of doing things. And I suppose that's what I'm just trying to highlight, that kind of possibility, that reimagining of religion. I mean, I say reimagining, it's already there, but I think a lot of people are not aware of it.
Well, thank you for your time. Everyone go buy his books. He has kids to feed. And yeah, thank you for coming on.
Absolutely. If you've learned nothing else in this discussion, what you need to remember is buy my bloody books. That's the important thing, because it's getting desperate. I'm just being silly. You know, I wish we had more time to talk. It's been very enjoyable. We'll have to do this again in the near future sometime. Thanks for doing what you're doing, Emerson.
All right. Talk to you later.
Cheers.
All right. Thank you for listening. That was Professor Philip Goff. And In addition to buying his books, you should use whatever remaining money you have in your bank account to go to patreon.com/waldenpod to help me feed my child and two cats. And you can go to my link tree, which is in the show notes, where you can support me in other ways. But if you hate me and want me to starve, you can just like the video, subscribe, share it, share the podcast with your friends, family, rabbi. Take my podcast, plug it into a giant speaker, go to Waco, Texas, and blare it at the Branch Davidians until they go insane. If you're from the Durham area in the UK and you want to hang out, too bad, you already missed it. The conference already happened. But I will be at a different conference sometime later this year. It's called the Best Philosophy Conference Ever, and I'm tentatively, very tentatively, planning on going to that. Let me look up the details here. Okay, so it is called the Greatest Philosophy Conference of All Time. It's going to happen on September 19th through September 20th of this year, 2025. Looks like it's at Purdue University. A few of the speakers are Michael Bergman, Nevin Clemenhaga, Wes Morriston, Eugene Nagasawa, Timothy O'Connor, Graham Oppie, Daniel Rubio, J.L. Schellenberg, who I had the privilege of meeting in Durham, Richard Swinburne, Michael Tooley, and I'm going to be there in the crowd, heckling. And I think some of my equally cretinous friends who you might have seen on this channel will also be there. So if you want to hang out with us and have a good time, I mean, the philosophy conferences, they really are fun. If you've never been and you like this channel, you like talking about philosophy, it actually is genuinely always a good time. Okay, so again, nothing is set in stone. I no longer have any control over my life because of the aforementioned child. So the plan is to be there. Can't guarantee anything, but as far as I know, I'm going to be there. So do consider that. All right, thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I will see you next time.